Good evening. It is wonderful to see you all here tonight. Thank you for coming. Love that. Love that. I know you didn't come to hear me speak, but you're going to have to bear with me just for a little bit. Some of you around where you're seated, you're going to see some little pieces of paper. That is to scan a QR code. When John is done with his story, sharing his story, we're going to have an opportunity for some questions and answer time. So if that's something you're interested in participating in, go ahead and scan that code. It is a public shared Google document, so just be mindful of that as you share. In addition, if there is something else that comes to mind a little bit more intricate in detail, feel free to grab an orange card and fill in your question or comment or concern on the back. And there's a little black box that's on the side of the sound booth back there, and you can just drop that in there. So again, I'm really excited you are all here tonight. I get the wonderful privilege to introduce our speaker tonight, and I thought of all the colorful ways I could do this. And man, I was tempted to share some stories, but I will say this. It is a privilege to know John. From what I remember of days past, he was a curious person, curious in his youth, curious as an adult, and that curiosity has led him far. He has experienced things that have been wonderful and exhilarating and doors that have opened to him that have given him opportunity and avenue to explore different adventures, both in life and education and so on. And I'll let him fill you in, but I love John's curiosity. And I would invite you all to be the same tonight, curious, right? Let's just be curious together without judgment and just listen and engage tonight. What an opportunity we have to hold someone's story with integrity. And I'm just excited tonight for what gets illuminated and the impact that can be had in simply sharing your story. So I'm not going to continue to yammer on anymore. I'm going to welcome John to the platform here. Would you give him a warm welcome?
Thanks. All right. You know, it's funny. Barry and I were doing a sound check, and I remember I just had this flashback of, like, I don't know how old I was, 8, 9, 10, and there was a play done here called Heaven's Gates and Hell's Flames. And it was like, it was this big thing of, like, you know, people's last moments and did they go to heaven and did they go to hell? And this is not going to be that. I promise you. But it was kind of this moment for me. Thank you for coming. My name is John Seidel and it's really good to be back here. I spent some time down by the river before I got here. And it's really cool to see a lot of familiar faces. What I would say is, anything you hear tonight that is great and awesome and encouraging and insightful is not me. And anything that you hear that you disagree with and you think is awful, that's probably me. So forgive me for that, kind of going into this. I like to say that I am the Christian that became an alcoholic, not the other way around. And I think usually it's the other way around, right? And we tend to be okay, at least, with the other way around. The person who's an alcoholic or an addict of any sort that becomes a Christian, and we celebrate those stories and we clap, and that's awesome. But yet, I think there are plenty of other people, and what we don't realize is people who love Jesus, who know Jesus, and still struggle and still fall into those things that trip them up. And so if you are here tonight and you're one of those people who follows Jesus and loves Jesus, like, that's great and you're going to get something. But I also think that if you're here and you're not one of those people, that there's still going to be plenty here for you. Before we kind of get into my story, I wanted to talk about some stuff that I think is really important. And that is, what is an alcoholic? And I think there's a lot of people who are like, well, that seems pretty obvious. And it's actually not. And I think because it's not, that actually kept me in bondage a lot longer. And so before I get to that, though, I just wanted to show you, this is my family. And so that's my wife. I had this little lady, but it doesn't work on here. That's my wife, Brett, on the right. That's my son, Jack, and my daughter, Annie. This is us last summer. And so they're back in Dallas. I live in Dallas, and I can guarantee you that they're as mad about the Micah Parsons trade as you probably think they are. And I love it. I can't get enough of it. So anyways, this is my lovely family. But before then, we kind of go, what is an alcoholic? And I think, like, I talk about this in my book that's coming out next month, but if you imagine an alcoholic, I think there's an image that comes to mind for a lot of us, right? And for a lot of us, it's that image of someone who's maybe, you know, spent all their money. It's the image of that person who's underneath the viaduct. It's the person that's just, you know, thrown everything away and pursued alcohol, right? And maybe it's not quite like that for you, but to some degree, I think it's true, right? But what's really interesting is that in 2013, the medical community actually changed the way they diagnose and talk about alcoholism. And they used to have these set of questions, and if you answered most of the questions yes, then you were either alcohol abuser or alcohol dependent. And if you didn't answer those questions a certain way, you were good, except you weren't good. And they realized that. They realized, oh my gosh, there's so many other people that are being left, you know, by the wayside because we don't have a proper understanding of what this is. And so I think one of the things that they did was they changed alcoholism to actually be on a spectrum now. Right. And so we're familiar with a spectrum with, you know, maybe autism spectrum, right? You can be over here or you can be over here. And now alcoholism is on a spectrum. And so what is really fascinating is that they now have these questions that you have to answer about your alcohol use, and they call it alcohol use disorder. And there's 11 questions now, and you only have to answer two of them to be considered on the spectrum. And so I'll go through these real quickly. It says, number one, alcohol is often taken in larger amounts or over a longer period than was intended. Two, there is persistent desire or unsuccessful efforts to cut down or control alcohol use. A great deal of time is spent in activities necessary to obtain alcohol, use alcohol, or recover from its effects. Craving or a strong desire or usage or urge to use alcohol. Recurrent alcohol use resulting in a failure to fulfill rote obligations at work, school, or home. Continued alcohol use despite having persistent or recurring social or interpersonal problems caused by or exacerbated by the effects of alcohol. Important social, occupational, or recreational activities are given up or reduced because of alcohol use. Recurrent alcohol use in situations in which it is physically hazardous. Alcohol use is continued despite knowledge of having a persistent or recurring physical or psychological problem that is likely to have been caused or exacerbated by alcohol. And then you have the tolerance issues and the withdrawal issues. Here's the thing. As you're going to hear, when I kind of had my rock bottom moment, like I would have answered yes to a lot of these, right? But what's great about this is, like, 6 months prior, I would have answered yes to a lot of these as well. But with the old way that we talked about alcoholism, I would have been good. And so I kind of talk about it like, if we had a way to find cancer 6 months, a year sooner, and say, oh my gosh, like, there's a problem here, we'd take that, right? And so now with the way that we talk about alcoholism and being an alcoholic, we have that opportunity, right? And so it's what I love about making sure that we get the definition right. But I think there's a better definition. And it's a very simple definition. And that is this. Anything that is misordered is disordered. Misordered equals disordered. And so if you're here tonight and you're listening and like maybe your drug of choice is not alcohol, maybe it's fentanyl, like maybe it's cocaine, maybe it's meth, maybe it's food, maybe it's sex, maybe it's Netflix, maybe it's your phone. Anything that is misordered is disordered. So what is really important about this is that it's not about quantity. Like, if you go back to those questions, like, did you see how many of them were about quantity? Like, not a lot, right? And so anything that we put in a misordered part of our lives becomes disordered. And I think it's really important for us to understand that. And what I realized is that even though I had from 2021, from the fall of 2021 to the spring of 2023, I call it my severe slide period. Like, that's where I look like a traditional alcoholic, right? Like, where I'm staying home, I'm driving drunk, like all of the things, right? I'm hiding it, as I'm throwing away beer cans, I'm putting them in the bottom of the trash, like all those things, right? Like, that's what we think of. But a year earlier, when I was 26, like, this would have applied. And dang, I really wish I would have known that. I really wish I would have seen the warning signs. Here's what's interesting, though. You guys have the distinct pleasure of living where you live. And so I don't use these slides in other places, but you guys get to use these slides because, unfortunately, and I talk about this in my book, that there's several different layers to how you become an alcoholic. One of them is the cultural layer, right? And the cultural layer, I think that there's a stat about how many millions of dollars was spent on alcohol advertising for the Super Bowl in 2022. It's insane, right? But you guys are getting inundated with it here in Wisconsin, and especially this area. And so I'm just going to, like, so this is excessive drinking in the United States. Percentage who are excessive drinkers by county. Like, you can outline Wisconsin. Like, that's crazy. But it gets better. You go here. Oh, there we go. Okay, there's more. There's another. This interactive map ranks every county in America from drunkest to driest. Right again. There you go. And you can't see this, but it says the 50 drunkest counties in the U.S. per percentage of adults who binge drink heavily. And there you go. And then this one, I was at coffee this morning and a guy showed me this. This was the caption. A new survey ranked which states, sorry for that typo, pound the most beers during an 18-hole round of golf. And the results are not shocking. And why are they not shocking? Because Wisconsin is at the top with 5.2. And the guy that I was sitting with is like, that's like the front nine. You know? And it's true. It's true. And so I think this is why I was excited to come back here, because I think you guys are being inundated, and it's cultural. When I tell people in other parts of the country that at the Catholic picnics, they have beer trucks, they laugh at me. And I'm like, it's the truth. It's the truth, right? And so I think you, of all people, are even more susceptible, right? Because it's constantly being hammered down your throat. In fact, there was one time when I first started talking about this, someone was like, man, I don't know, John, by that definition of alcohol use disorder, like, all of us in Wisconsin have a disorder. And I'm kind of like, yeah, I know, right? Like, that's kind of the point, right? So tonight, what I want to talk about, though, is two things. What leads to addiction, and how especially do you follow Jesus and still become an alcoholic? And so some of you are here, and, maybe you're used to the language of AA, and you have a higher power, and I've literally met someone whose higher power is a light socket, and what I would say is I get to tell you who that higher power really is, and the source, the power that goes into that light socket, right? So we're going to talk about that. But I want to ask you this, like, you look at these pictures, and what do you see? So this is me baptizing my daughter in the middle. This is us at the pumpkin patch. Yes, we're in shorts and a t-shirt because it's not 51 degrees in October now that we live in Dallas. And that's me at my daughter's Christmas party, or my Christmas program. In that right picture, I am drunk as a skunk. You wouldn't know that, right? my wife almost kicked me out of there because I was being so unruly, she said. And I was like, I'm singing along with Santa Claus. Like, what are you talking about? I went, that picture of me baptizing my daughter, it was, I think, about 2 weeks later that I had my rock bottom moment. And I think for a lot of people, again, you see this and you think everything's fine, right? Everything's fine. Everything's great. Until it isn't. In 2021, I wrote a best-selling book called Finding Rest, and it was on faith and mental health. And I traveled the country. This is just one of the opportunities I had. They flew me down to Nashville. I'm on with Mike Huckabee, who's now the ambassador to Israel. Put me up in a nice hotel, me and my wife. Like, became a top 100 book on all of Amazon, and life is great, right? But it's not. Because in 2021, after the book came out, I had a buddy call me up and he said, John, you really need to be careful. And I said, okay. He said, you're going to write the book and you're going to do the press tour and you're going to get to the end and you're going to feel empty. And I'm like, I'm literally writing the book on faith and mental health. Like, I'm good, right? And sure enough, get to the book came out in September, get to about October, November. And I kind of joke that, like, if you've seen the movie Talladega Nights, like Ricky Bobby, he's like, he's doing these interviews, like, what do I do with my hands, right? He doesn't know what to do with himself. And that's kind of what I felt like. And so I had expectations for the book. Yes, it was a bestseller on Amazon, but it didn't make the New York Times bestseller list. Or, you know, it got reviewed by Publishers Weekly, but the Wall Street Journal didn't do a review of it, right? I got Huckabee, but I didn't get the Today Show, right? And so you just start feeling like, my goodness, I'm a failure. And where does that stuff come from, right? Like, John, like, what, like, this is stuff great. And I would say, there's a guy called the devil that actually exists. And what he does is he taps into the lies and the insecurities that started when you were 6, when you were 16, when you were 26. And he twists them just enough, right? And so he starts twisting these things and saying, like, no one likes you, no one wants to read your book, like, this is a failure. And I just start believing him. Then you fast forward to December of that year. I had a consulting company in digital media because I've had the opportunity to do some cool stuff. I've worked for Glenn Beck. I started a website called The Blaze. I worked for Kirk Cameron, done projects with Chip and Joanna Gaines, which is kind of a hot topic now, sorry. But I do all that stuff, and I start this consulting business, and I'm making the most money of my life. Like, I have a company that hires me, and I'm directing. Like, remember Rico Suave? Does anyone remember Rico Suave? Like, I'm literally directing a film with Rico Suave. And 2 weeks before Christmas, they call me up, and they say, John, hey, we're going in a different direction. We're kind of reevaluating some things, and your contract is up at the end of the year. And I'm like, well, they're my biggest client. Like, they were paying me all this money. I wasn't going out and trying to find other clients. And I start getting even more depressed. And then you fast forward to the spring, and I built up another client, and they pull out. And I'm left with nothing. And then my son starts limping around. And we're kind of looking, he's 4 years old, and we're like, what is going on? And so we take him to the pediatrician, and they say, oh, he's fine. And my wife, being the good mama bear that she is, she's like, no, he's not fine. And we bring him to a pediatric orthopedic specialist. And you kind of have that moment where they're like, hey, we've scheduled an appointment. With an oncologist. And here's the crazy thing. He's fine, right? Like, it ends up being benign, and they treat it with a lot of NSAIDs. and he's fine. But that whole process of taking through that and the uncertainty of that, and all throughout, I just continue to go to what I found was really easy, cheap relief. Like, I could go to therapy and spend $150. I don't know how much therapy is around here, guys, but by me, it's like $150 a pop. That's expensive. I have to, like, schedule that. I have to go. Or I could go to Goody Goody Liquor Store and buy, like, a decent bottle of bourbon for $20. And that lasts me a lot longer than the hour session that it does to go to therapy. And so all throughout this period, it's a slow fade. And I just start drinking more and more and more and more. And one bourbon every night turns into two, turns into four, turns into five. Drinking at after the kids go to bed turns to drinking at five because it is 5 o'clock somewhere. And then that starts at three. And now, because I don't have any work, I'm sitting home. And what do I do at 10 or one or whatever? I mean, I don't have to be present, right? My wife's picking up the kids, and I just start drinking more and more and more and more. And then in May 2023, my wife and I are celebrating our 14-year anniversary, and our anniversary is right around Memorial Day. And so we always try to plan a trip, right? And you got a built-in vacation, like everything's great. And so we planned on going to Miami. I'd never been to Miami. And my wife gets this really cool hotel on South Beach. And what's so fascinating is that 2 weeks before the trip, I start realizing, I think I have a problem. In fact, I went to my wife and I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And like any good alcoholic, I stopped drinking for 2 weeks and said, I'm obviously not an alcoholic. Because alcoholics can't stop drinking for 2 weeks, right? So we go down to Miami and I say, well, I'm good. I've been kind of like saving up for this. Like, I'll just drink a little bit. I'll just drink at night, right? I won't drink during the day. I won't even drink on the beach. Okay, great. And so I'm drinking a little bit. And there's one night where my wife wants to stay in. She's a reader and she says, hey, I'm just gonna like read in bed. Like, you can do whatever you want. But like, you know, she was even like, if you want to go, there was like a basketball game in town. She's like, if you want to go get tickets to the basketball game, I'm like, no, I think I'm just gonna go down to the hotel bar. See, cause I'm not a party drinker. I'm not a go out. I'm not stay in the bars. Like, that's not my thing. I'm an alone drinker. I need to shut my mind off because I also have diagnosed anxiety and OCD. And so when thoughts race, when I can't get things out of my head, again, it's really cheap to go to the liquor store. It's really easy to have four or five bourbons. So I said, no, babe, I'm just going to go down to the hotel bar. And she looks at me and she says, okay. Don't get drunk. By this time, that had become a very popular refrain. And I looked at her and I said, I'm not going to get drunk. And I can say very honestly, you hooked me up to a lie detector. I did not plan on getting drunk. So I go down to the hotel bar. I meet Jorge. Like that. I'm sorry, that sounds like it's made up, but that was literally his name in Miami. And I said, hey, what's your special? And he said, gin martinis with an onion garnish. Great. I love gin and I love onions. And he said, they're kind of strong. And I said, all the better. And I have one. And I don't know how many I had after that. Because the next thing I know, it's about 12:01 in the morning. And I am shit-faced in every aspect of the term. And I have this moment where I'm like, I can't go up to the room because I can barely walk, and I will wake up my wife and she will know that I got drunk after promising her not to get drunk. And so Drunk John has a great idea. Drunk John says, okay, no matter what they tell you, the only thing that can sober you up is time. Like, you can eat all the bread and brats and whatever you want, but it's not going to sober you up. So I knew that. So I said, I'm going to go down to the beach, and I'm just going to sit, because we're right on South Beach. I'm just going to sit there, and I'm just going to wait until I can walk better than what I can walk now. So I get down to the beach. Here's one thing you don't know. I got one of those. I went to Quick Trip because I had to get my see you next time, you know, because the Quick Trips in Dallas don't tell you that, right? So I went to Quick Trip right before I got here, and I got I got this Mega Buddy, right? And my grandma, who I love dearly, blessed me with a lot of things. One of the things she blessed me with that I'm not grateful for is a very small bladder. And so when I drink anything, including the soda, I've gone to the bathroom like 4 times before I came out here. So I get down to the beach, and I really have to go to the bathroom. Here's what you don't realize about South Beach, Miami, at 1 in the morning. There's a lot of people there doing all sorts of things, right? And I'm like, what is that skunky smell, you know? And like, there's all this stuff. And so I get down there. I have to go to the bathroom. I can't make it back to the hotel. Like, there's no bathroom around here. I'm like, what am I going to do? So Drunk John has a good idea. Drunk John says, the world's largest toilet is in front of me. And so, with all my clothes on, I wade into the ocean, and I start going to the bathroom, and it starts coming out of both ends. And I just have this moment where I look up, and this is literally what I see. I went back and took a picture of it. And I'm like, what has my life become? Like, I seriously set out not to get drunk tonight. I did. And now, it's 1 in the morning, I'm waiting in my own feces, and I'm like, what the heck? And I skipped over this picture, but you talk about having a problem. This is me and my wife the previous night, where this is the first restaurant we went to, and I ordered a beer, and I drank 3/4 of it, and she excuses herself to the bathroom. As soon as she excuses herself to the bathroom, I get the bartender to quickly give me another beer. I slam that one. I slam the one that I was drinking. I have him give me another one. I drink that 3/4 of the way so that when my wife come back, it doesn't look like I've really drank anything. And then I finish that, and then I order another one. So I don't know, what am I, 4 or 5 beers deep in 5 minutes? But I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem. Alcoholics can't quit for 2 weeks. So the next, I guess I sober up. I mean, I guess that's kind of sobering. I go back to the hotel room. I wake up the next day, and I always prided myself on, like, I don't get hangovers. I've never got hangovers, which, again, if you're an alcoholic, you get a hangover, right? Like, I could never, like, I've rarely drank myself into a hangover, no matter how much I've drank. I wake up with a hangover, and I think it's about 10, 11. My wife has a text, and she's like, hey, I'm down by the beach. Come down when you're ready. And so I come down, and I'm like, oh, God, she's going to ask me about last night. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And so sure enough, like, I get down there. She's like on this little cabana thing. And pretty quickly, she finds a way to bring up. She's like, hey, so did you get drunk last night? And just so quickly and so easily, I said, no, I didn't get drunk last night. Like, maybe a little tipsy, but I didn't get buzzed, whatever. I didn't get drunk. Okay. 2 times throughout the rest of the day, she asked me the same thing. Hey, did you get drunk last night? And so quickly and so easily, no, I didn't get drunk last night. I call it my Peter moment. You know, like Peter in the Passion story, like, he denies Jesus 3 times. And so I have my Peter moment, and man, but I am just being eaten up. I'm like, oh my gosh, like I need to tell her. And so we booked dinner that night at some Latin place. And we get there and I order a Coke Zero and we order food and I'm just kind of picking at it. And finally I'm like, hey babe, I need to tell you something. I was like, hey, I did get drunk last night. And I think there was a part of me that was like, I'm just going to tell her, you know, she'll be thankful that I told her. I'll get in a little bit of trouble. And she just starts bawling. Excuses herself to the bathroom. She comes back and she says, I knew you got drunk last night. I knew you did. But I wanted to give you the opportunity to let me know. And she says, you lied so easily and so quickly. Like, I don't think you know what that does to a woman. Like, what else are you lying about? What else could you lie about? So I pay the bill. I don't think I ate anything because you're not going to eat clams when you're feeling like that. And we start walking. Like, we leave the restaurant. We just start walking, not talking. And we actually end up at the beach, the same area where I was kind of the night before. And I'm making all the promises, like, I will never drink again. I will get help. You know, I have a problem. I really did not set out to get drunk last night. I can't stop when I start. And we're sitting there, and she goes, John, I don't care if you ever drink again. Like, that's not my goal. And she said, if you never drink again, like, I won't be happy. She said, you have to get to the root of why you're drinking. And I kind of have this moment, and I'm like, can we go back to the part where I don't drink again? That would be easier. Because what she knew is that there were things I had just buried for years. Things that happened to me, things that I experienced, things I'd seen, things I'd done. That, like, I don't want to go there. I would rather not drink for the rest of my life than to have to go there. But we had recently started talking about this. And so we were talking about me going to, like, this Christian trauma therapist. And I pull up my phone, and I literally include this. I found the email, and I include it in the book. And I fill out the form to this woman's website, and I say, hey, my name's John. I think I have some issues in my past and some things that I haven't dealt with, and it's leading me to be an alcoholic. And I'd like to come talk to you about it. We get back to Dallas, and that starts a year of intense therapy where every Tuesday, Wednesday, I drive down to like Dallas. It's really, it's kind of interesting in Texas. Like, every town has like a town square, like an old town square. And so, like, my therapist was in this town square on the fourth floor. There's like literally ballerinas on the bottom. It's really quaint. And I would go up there and we would dig in. We would dig in. Like, there's kind of this term now and it's overused and I'm so sorry, but it's actually works here. But, like, we dig into the triggers. It's like when you get in an argument with your spouse and you're like, why am I in fight or flight mode? Because you told me that you actually wanted 10 nuggets instead of 5. Like, those stupid arguments. And you're like, what? I'm activated. I'm triggered. Like, what is that? Right? And so we dug into those things. And in the end, at the end of every session, we would invite Jesus in. to speak into those things, to heal those things, to reveal even more things, which I'm still doing and is not fun. And slowly, over the course of that year, things started to change. I was on a podcast this morning with this neuroscientist, and I was sharing my story, and I was like, my life got really good over that year, but it did not get necessarily better. What I mean by that is when you start digging into those things that make you who you are, like, I found a peace. I made a peace with that, but it is not fun. Like, it's hard. And so I tell people, like, when I encourage you to get sober, I am not the person that's going to tell you that it is exciting and, like, it's roses and butterflies and rainbows and, like, all the things, right? Like, there were times where I'm literally, like, just pacing around my living room after my wife goes to bed. Because for the last year and a half, that's when I would, like, that's when I would really kick it into high gear. I don't have to go anywhere. No one has to see me. And I can just drink myself to sleep, right? I'm, like, just pacing. What do I do with myself? There was this thing that happened to me that I said would never happen to me. And that is, for years, I'm like, I think I'm fine because I don't have any, like, physical symptoms. Like, some people get the shakes and some people, you know, stuff like that. I quit drinking. And I had this weird thing where every night I'd wake up at about 1 a.m. and I'd be completely wet. And my sheets would be wet, and I'd have to change pajamas. And I realized, oh, and I, like, Google it, you know. It's like, oh, that's a withdrawal symptom. Oh, but I didn't have any of those. I thought I was fine, right? I said that I dug into some of those things, and I want to get to a little bit of that, but I think there's this question, in a sense, that I think we need to answer, like, what leads to addiction? And I think you have people on different sides of the spectrum, right? Like, there are some people who are like, it's only a physical thing. It's a disease. And there's this thing, it's called the disease model of addiction. And it's like a virus, in a sense, right? It's in your blood. And then there are other people who are like, no, it's only a spiritual issue. And where I land is, like, it is both a physical and a spiritual issue. Like, for me, there were so many things that I had learned to suppress, or habits that I had formed. Like, my ultimate addiction was not to alcohol. My ultimate addiction was to escapism. There's this woman who wrote a book called The Many Lives of Mama Love. And she's, like, this suburban woman in, I don't know, like, Ohio or something. And she became, like, this insane crack dealer and ends up in prison, and she writes a book about it. And she says, I only ever chased the white whale of addiction, escapism. And so, if you're listening to this, like, think about that. Because I think whether your drug of choice is gambling, whether it's alcohol, whether, again, it's fentanyl, whether it's food, whether it's your phone, like, in so many senses, aren't you just trying to escape? Even if it's in that moment, right? And someone asked me once, they're like, John, like, so are you saying, like, you're thinking about maybe some of the stuff that, like, happened to you in the past and, like, you're just trying to drink that away? And I'd be like, well, like, sometimes, like, maybe there's an anniversary that comes up and you're like, man, this kind of sucks. Like, I don't want to think about that. But it's really that. It's like, I don't want to think about that, right? So there's that, but there's also, like, you learn these habits of escapism. And so at six, when you're trying to make sense of something that might have happened to you, you deal with, you know, you use Tonka trucks and Barney. But when you're 26, you use tequila and bourbon. Because you've learned the habit of escaping. I don't want to deal with that. I just don't want to deal with that, right? And again, culture is telling you all the time. Like I posted this thing on my Instagram account when I was in the airport coming here. And it said, it was a sign in the airport, and it said, wine is like duct tape. It fixes everything. And like, that's the culture that we live in, right? And especially, and go back to the stats, but like, especially here. Like my brother joked about that. He's like, I feel like there's like a sign like that, like everywhere here. I'm like, yeah, I think there is. So when it comes to addiction, it's both a physical problem and a spiritual problem. What I've realized, though, is that the spiritual aspects go way deeper. And they were there way before the physical aspect took over for me, right? Like, by the end, I'm obviously having withdrawal symptoms. Like, there's a physical draw for the substance, right? Like, I'm not doing things that make sense. Like, literally what happens, and you can go on my podcast and I talk about this to different people, but there's literally, like, when you drink, you don't use the prefrontal cortex. It like shuts off. The prefrontal cortex is what you use to like make decisions and say, I should not get in the car after 10 beers, right? But like, it literally shuts off. So there is that physical aspect, but there's really the spiritual aspect that was present long before. And I think the spiritual aspect is the heart of everything, because the spiritual aspect deals with something called trauma. And there are many names for trauma. I think the best thing, though, like, in the end, trauma is brokenness. It's rupture. It's the fact that we live in a world where sin exists. And because sin and brokenness exist, you all have, I guarantee you, you all have experienced trauma.
Well, John, you're just like, you're just trying to convince everyone that they have, you know, something bad happened to them in their childhood.
By the way, I'm sorry, I use a southern accent now when I do that. I just noticed that. It's from living in Dallas too long. And I would say, I'm not trying to convince you of anything. I'm just telling you the truth. Because there's no way that you have gone through life without experiencing trauma. You just have. Now, here's the thing. There's big T trauma and there's little T trauma. The big T trauma is things like, you know, the things that we associate it with, the sexual abuse, the physical abuse, the verbal abuse, the abandonment, the death, right? But there's also these things in the little T trauma category, divorce, lack of attunement. Attunement is like, has someone really paid attention to what you're going through? Illness, addiction in your family. Food scarcity? Like, did you know where your next meal is going to come from? Manipulation, narcissism, expectations. Two things I want to talk about here. How many of you, like, directly, your parents divorced? Like, I'm curious. Okay. And, like, how many of you have a close family member where divorce is present? So, just because divorce is very, like, prevalent now doesn't mean it's not traumatic, right? Like, I was talking with someone the other day, and they were saying, like, well, my kids were really little when I divorced their mom, and so I think they're fine. And I'm like, just because the kid doesn't remember you being around or doesn't remember the actual divorce. Like when you tear apart a family, no matter how good it is. I have a friend in Dallas who just got divorced and he's like telling me, man, it was a really amicable thing. Like it went really well. And then like he starts telling me the details. I'm like, your definition of going really well is very different than mine. Because your third grade daughter last week witnessed the cops come over to deal with the issue that you were having with your wife. But that's your definition of going really well. Just because it's common does not mean that there's not issues. And I mean, my dad, who's watching this, and I love him, like left in the middle of the night and never came back. Illness. For the last 2.5 years, my wife has struggled with a lot of autoimmune diseases caused by a car accident. And 3 weeks ago, today, she had a full hysterectomy plus some other stuff that I'm a man and don't quite understand. And last week, I'm tucking my son in, and he says, said, Daddy, is mommy dying? I said, no, buddy. Mom's not dying. But I know that that's something that deeply affects him. And he's seven. I want to say something here that I think is really important, because maybe you're a parent and you're listening to this, and I want to like be clear that no matter what you do and no matter how good of a parent you are, you will cause trauma to your kids. It's like, I fully expect that my daughter is 10 right now. Like she will come to me in 10 years and she'll say, Dad, remember when mom was going through all that stuff? And like you responded to me in that way. And there was that time where she had the hysterectomy and like you said some stuff to me when you were, you know, whatever. And that like really hurt. And like, I can give all the explanations. Like, well, it was a really hard time. Like, I was going through a lot. Your mom was going through a lot. Or I can say, yeah, you're right. I effed that one up. What can I do about it? Because the point is not that you won't cause trauma. It's how you repair it. There will be rupture. There always is rupture. Again, we live in a fallen, broken, sinful world. You will cause trauma. How do you repair it? There's a guy named Dan Siegel. He's a psychiatrist or I don't know. He's really smart. He's written a lot of books and they're really good. And he says that in the end, we have four core needs. They are to be safe, seen, soothed, and secure. And really, trauma is any absence or rupture of those. And so can you think back in your life, like any time that you've not felt safe, not felt seen, not felt soothed, not felt secure? There's another guy who's done a ton of work with addicts. His name is Gaber Marte. He wrote this book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And he talks about how trauma is a rupture that happens in the absence of an empathetic witness. Like, think about that for a second. Like, I'm sure there are things that have happened to you in your life, but you've had an empathetic witness in the moment, right? And you've been able to deal with them and you've been able to talk through them and you get to, and you're like, okay, I'm in a good spot. But how many of us have not felt safe, seen, soothed, or secure? And not had someone to really process that with. And that doesn't mean you had bad parents, right? Like you may have been beaten up on the playground by Billy, And there was no one there to be an empathetic witness. There was no one there to walk you through that. And then maybe when you got home and you told your dad, who had just worked double shifts at the Manitowoc Company, and he's just like so tired, and he gives you like, hey, you know, let's talk about that tomorrow, and he never talks to you about it. Kurt Thompson is a great Christian psychiatrist, and he says this: we all are born into the world looking for someone looking for us, and we remain in this mode of searching for the rest of our lives. Who are you looking for in life? How do you become an alcoholic, Christian alcoholic? Listen, there's a lot of ways you can answer that question. And there's a lot smarter people than I who have answered that question. But I think a big part of it is you bury parts of yourself that you don't want to come out. Things happen in your life, even in your adult life. Like, it's not like this all happens when you're only a kid, right? Like, I have some of those big T traumas in my life. I have some of those little T traumas in my life. Some of them happened when I was young, but some of them happened when I was adult, right? And if you don't deal with them, and you bury them and bury them and bury them, guess what? It's really easy to drink them away. And so part of what I'm hoping that you take from this tonight is that when I talk about alcohol in my book and in my work, it's really just a vehicle. And so I've said it a couple times, but I'll say it again. Maybe your drug of choice is food. Maybe it's shopping. Maybe it's fentanyl. Maybe it's fill in the blank. But like, I want something better for you than what that drug offers. Because alcohol promised me so many things and it failed to deliver on all of them. It promised me peace. It promised me happiness. It promised me relief. And it failed on all of them until you find yourself in the middle of the ocean wading in your own feces being like, how the hell did I get here? Because I truly set out not to get drunk tonight. We have inside of us parts. And so like, I'm not talking about like multiple personalities. I'm skipping over some of this. We'll talk about this in a second. I'm not talking about multiple personalities, but here's, who's seen the movie Inside Out? Like the Disney movie, right? And if you see the Disney movie Inside Out, like, there's like, I think there's like five characteristics, and they live inside this little girl, and you know, at some point, like, anger comes out, and at some point, joy comes out, and like, all this stuff. And it's really cute. It's the best explanation that I found for the parts of us that exist. And here's the thing. You can have really healthy parts of yourself that thrive and do amazing stuff. Like, they're the president of the bank. Right? They're the ones that gets you to the top. For me, it's the ones that can write a best-selling book. They're the ones that can be successful. They're the ones that can, you know, direct movies with Rico Suave, right? But let's say I'm made up of 100 parts. And 99 of those parts are healthy. But there's that one. There's that one that hears the lies and says, you know what? You're not worth it. And that one part is the one that's an alcoholic. And he doesn't come out every minute of every day. But man, when he gets what he wants, like, he ruins it for everyone else, right? Here's the problem. If we don't heal those parts of us that for whatever reason have been ruptured, we're just going to go on doing the same thing we've always done. And in fact, there's this field of study called epigenetics. And you see the definition up here. It's the study of how your environment and behaviors can change the way your genes work without changing the underlying DNA sequence itself. What does that mean? It means that while trauma or circumstances or fill in the blank can't change your genetic makeup. It can change what aspects of your genes are expressed. And so I think there are some of you here who, like, your grandpa was an alcoholic and your dad was an alcoholic and you're an alcoholic, and you look at your kids and you're like, holy crap, like, they're starting to do that some stuff. And what I want to posit to you is that because you haven't broke the cycle and you haven't healed those parts of yourself, it's just going to keep going. And so I'm going to do this fun thing with you guys. So let's say that this is the traumatic thing that happened to you, right? Let's say maybe this is even your grandpa. So life kind of stirs that up. And this is grandpa. And then grandpa passes down some of those habits or those ways of coping, passes that down to your dad. And your dad passes it down to you. And what do you notice? Like, it's a little less blue, but like not a big difference, right? So what do you need? What do you need to do to break the cycle? Well, you need someone who's pure, who's spotless, and that person comes in and now what do you notice? You can get sober without Jesus. I know there's AA people here. I love you guys. You can get sober without Jesus. Millions of people have. But you're not healing trauma by not drinking. You're not healing the rupture that's happened in your life by just not drinking. Like, I'm excited that you're here in the sense of, like, you're alive and you're not drinking yourself to death, right? And I know there's, like, I still subscribe to the HTR and still read all that stuff. And, like, I know there was this big thing about, like, do you have the Narcan vending machine? And I'm like, come on. Like, yes, have the Narcan vending machine. Because the person who is dying of an overdose on Marshall Street, like, I want them alive and we should give them Narcan. And we shouldn't pretend that, oh my gosh, it's Manitowoc. If we have a Narcan vending machine, what are people going to think? Oh my, it's going to attract people. No, they're all doing it, guys, right? Like, I want you to be sober. I want you to stop drinking. I want you to be alive. I want you to be here, okay? But how many of you know a miserable sober person? Right. And here's my point. The miserable sober person, they're doing it. They're sober, right? Like, great. Like, according to all the programs and the whatnot, like, they're killing it. They're sober. And I'm like, great. But what about all the other stuff? Because that is still being passed down. The root of why you drink needs to be dealt with. And there's only one person that I know that can do that. And that's why I talk about Jesus. Because here's the thing. I tried to stop drinking for years. Even though, like, from 2021 to 2023, I call it my severe slide period, I had that misordered equals disordered relationship with alcohol for a very long time. And I tried to stop drinking. And I would quit for 2 weeks or 2 months or 3 months. I even, like, lost a ton of weight where I only drank, like, one bourbon a week. That's great. Yeah, awesome. But I never addressed the roots of why I was drinking, right? And so I just kept coming back to it. And I wrote this article once. I said, how was I able to stop drinking? I finally stopped trying to stop drinking. Like, my favorite author in the world, his name is C.S. Lewis. He's dead now. I named my son after him, though. He wrote this book called Mere Christianity, and it is so good, and I'm in seminary now, and I had to read this, reread this book recently. And he's got this line in there. He says, if you shoot for heaven, you get the earth thrown in. If you shoot for Jesus, you will get sobriety. But if you shoot for sobriety, a lot of times, you don't get sobriety. You get stops and starts. And you may even get it, but you also might get a lot of misery too. Because no 12-step program can fix the sin and brokenness that has caused you to want to drink. There's something I want to make clear is that when I talk about trauma, when I talk about those root issues, those are an explanation. They are not an excuse. When I was in my heyday of drinking, one of the things I said I'd never do was I would never drive drunk. Well, I was driving drunk. I even had a cop follow me, and I thought, oh, this is it. I had a buddy who was a police officer. He said, usually you drive drunk 7 times before you get pulled over. And I'm like, I think I'm at way more than 7. Like, it's my time. And if I would have got pulled over, I didn't. But if I would have got pulled over, I couldn't just say to the cop, like, Ossifer, you don't understand. You don't understand the argument I got in with my wife. You don't understand the things that happened to me when I was 6. You don't understand the things that, like, he'd be like, great, blowing this thing and I'm bringing you down, right? Like, it's an explanation. It is not an excuse. I'm still responsible for my actions. You are still responsible for your actions. You may have had a really crappy upbringing. I talk about this stuff, like, I had a great upbringing. I really did. Just because there was some stuff that happened. But you don't get to say, hey, I struggled with these things, or these things happened, and like, that's my past. No, like, you're still responsible for your actions, right? I say to people, like, the stuff that you've experienced, even if you're sorry, like, that's not a get out of jail free card. And in fact, you might still have to go to jail for the things you did. Right? I met a guy, his name is Brandon Puffer. And he was a pitcher for the Texas Rangers, lived in my town in Texas. And one night, he's pitching for the AAA team. He kept getting called up but he's down in AAA, and he had been sober for like a couple of years. And the young guys are like, hey, come on, just come out with us once. He's like, you don't want to see that guy. So he holds him off. And he finally one night says yes. He says yes. Sober, 2 years. The next day, he's arrested. Because when he got so drunk, he was charged with attempted rape. Ended up in some woman's apartment. Brandon is very sorry for those actions. And like, was a born and raised in the church, was a Christian. And he finds himself in prison. And he's not once has said to me or to anyone, I don't deserve to be here. Like, I deserve to be here. Like, I did it. And he's the happiest man I know. Like, he's got such a smile on his face. He's out now. He runs like this baseball program. And he's like, you look at him and he smiles. Like, you just can't help but smile. He did not use his repentance as a get out of jail free card. Don't use your trauma. Don't use the crap that happened in your life. Don't use a repentance as a get out of jail free card. I want to end with this. I've been talking about this aspect of my own story. And I think we have a really interesting biblical example of this. And so, how many of you have heard the story or of the guy David, like King David in the Bible, right? Like he's considered, it says like he's a man after God's own heart. So he's like pursuing God with all he has. Jesus, you know, that guy, like part of the reason he's the Messiah is because he comes from David's line. Like you have to be part of David's line. Like that's how much the Jews love David. Like great guy. And yet we get this story in 2 Samuel, where it says, it happened late one afternoon when David arose from the couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? So David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him and he lay with her. Then she returned to her house and the woman conceived. And she sent and told David, I am pregnant. David raped her. Like, I just want to be clear about that. Like, this is not just like a moral failure. Like, he raped her. The man after God's own heart. I asked earlier, like, how do you get to be the Christian, the guy who believes in Jesus and loves Jesus and writes a book and like all that stuff and still become an alcoholic? How do you be a king, a guy after God's own heart? You have everything you want. And you go and you rape a woman. And then what's not here is that he then kills her husband. The Christian rapist, the Christian murderer. I was talking with Kurt Thompson, or he was giving a talk. And he pointed something out to me. If you know the story of David, you know that like Saul is the guy that's the king in front of him. And Saul does a lot of stupid stuff. And so the prophet Samuel talks with God. God says, hey, go find the next king. He says, go to Jesse. Jesse is David's dad. And so Samuel goes to Jesse and says, hey, can you show me all of your sons? I'm supposed to like find the next king. And so Jesse parades all of his sons out and says, like, look at these great guys. And Samuel's like, is there one missing? And Jesse's like, well, yeah, there's David. Like, that's a very odd thing. Like, think about that for a second. The prophet comes to your house and says, I want to see all your sons because I'm looking for the next king. And Jesse parades out his sons and leaves David. Do you think that's a little tea trauma? I do. Like, that's weird. But it gets worse. When David goes to the front lines in the Battle of Goliath to bring his brothers food, there's a story where one of them lashes out with anger, hate, vitriol, and he calls David conceited and wicked. I'm bringing you food. While playing his harp to soothe King Saul, the king loses it and throws a spear and tries to kill David. What? That same king then becomes his father-in-law, who then turns around and leads a long campaign to try and kill David. After that, his best friend, who happens to be Saul's son, dies in battle after they have to have like this secret friendship that they can't really tell Saul about. And then finally you get this story where David is king and he's bringing back this thing called the Ark of the Covenant, which is like the pinnacle of life in Israel. And he's so excited and he's so proud of himself. And he like just starts dancing as they're like parading this in, right? Like think of like the Super Bowl parade. Like, you dance a little bit, right? And his wife comes to him afterwards and mocks him and makes fun of him. I think David was a very wounded, hurt man. And wounded and hurt men who don't deal with their issues rape women and kill their husbands. And maybe you're not doing that, but what are you doing? David's father ignored him. His brother accosted him. His king and father-in-law tried to kill him. His best friend left him, and his wife shamed him. You know how I know David was a really wounded man, though? Because you get psalms like this. Words cut David to his core, and we have proof. My God, whom I praise, do not remain silent. For people who are wicked and deceitful have opened their mouths against me. They have spoken against me with lying tongues. With words of hatred they surround me. They attack me without cause. In return for my friendship they accuse me, but I am a man of prayer. They repay me evil for good and hatred for my friendship. How do you become a Christian alcoholic? How do you become a king who murders? You don't deal with the woundings from your childhood, from your adulthood, and you just keep passing it on. I told you earlier that I want you to have the best, most flourishing, fulfilled life. And I'm telling you that that is only possible through Jesus. You can find sobriety. You can stop drinking. That's great. But you're not going to have the most flourishing, fulfilled life. And I can tell you that 2.5 years into the sobriety thing, my life has become a picture that I never thought it would be. But here's the interesting part. My life has gotten harder. For 2.5 years, I've had to pick my wife off the floor. I had to empty her catheter bag for 2 weeks. Like, life sucks. And yet I can tell you that I am at peace. And I know there's people here like, who the hell is this guy? I don't know. I don't know. But my life is different and it is good. It has not necessarily gotten better, but it is good. And I want that for you. And the last thing I'll say is this. I think there's probably people who are listening to this and listening to me and whatnot, and they're saying, okay, you crapped yourself in the ocean. You were driving drunk. You were doing like all this stuff. I'm not doing that. Like, I'm fine. I want to tell you, the comparison game is a losing battle. There is only one worst alcoholic in the world. Do you realize this? There's only one worst gambler in the world. But the race for the top, like 150, like it's not a good race. Like, maybe you're not one, but even if you're like top 1,000, like, you don't get a medal for that. This is my sister. Some of you know her. Some of you know the story. My sister's like 2 years older than me. And for most of her life, she was a very tortured soul. And like, some of those traumas that I'm talking about, like she introduced them into my life. But I always looked at her for so long and said, at least I'm not like her. She did a lot of drugs. She did a lot of stuff. And I always said, at least I'm not like her. Like, I'm good. I'm good. 2018, she was in an accident on I-43 right around the Cleveland exit. And when I wrote my book, I actually sent it to Sarah, an early copy, because she had a family member who was struggling. And I'll never forget when she called me up. And I'm going to say this, and forgive me. I'm going to ask her for, like, forgiveness instead of permission. I think her exact words, like, were something along the lines of, how fucking sad. Like, I'm so heartbroken, Johnny. That's what they call me. That Jenny's not here to hear this. Because the way that you treated her and pretended that you were better than her for your whole life is so sad. And maybe I wasn't addicted to the drug that she was addicted to. But I had my own. But because I wasn't like her, I was fine. And that led me drunk in the ocean at 1 a.m. swimming in my own shit. But I'm not like her. My friend Tullian, if you can pronounce that last name, I'll give you something. It rhymes with religion, Tavidian. But you know Tullian because of a different name. See, his grandfather was Billy Graham. You talk about the stock, right? Like someone who knows all the right things and absolutely is nailing it. 2015, Tullian was pastoring Coral Ridge Church, which you've seen on TV because they used to play it every Sunday morning, D. James Kennedy. And it was exposed that Tullian was having an affair and he lost everything. And he slowly built up his life. You know, pastors a church that he very, in a funny way, says, it's a recovery meeting masquerading as a church down in Florida. He says, there are really only two kinds of people in this world. People in recovery who know they are and people in recovery who think they're not. You're addicted to something. You're addicted to something. My addiction, a little more obvious than yours, maybe. There's this guy, this really old guy, he's dead now, his name's John Calvin. He said, our hearts are idol factories. We can make an idol out of anything. You can make an idol out of exercise, food, shopping, alcohol, fentanyl. But we're all addicted to something. What I'm hoping that you take from tonight is that we are all on this journey of what's called messy sanctification. Sanctification is this idea that the moment we start following Jesus, we begin becoming more like him. My journey of messy sanctification looks like becoming an alcoholic and crawling my way back to Jesus. Your version of messy sanctification may not look like that, but that doesn't mean you're not on one. And here's the thing. The grace that Jesus offers is not just for the little things. It's not like you swore at a Bears fan, right? Like, it's also for the people who love Jesus, know Jesus, want Jesus, and still become alcoholics, right? And so my question to you, and I know I went a little long, and forgive me, and we'll do a little Q&A after this if you want to stay, but you can also go. I know there's a recovery meeting at, I think, 8. Is what are you going to do about it? Like, what are you going to do about it? You're addicted to something. Whether it's pride, whether it's narcissism, whether it's anger, what are you going to do about it? And I posit to you that the best thing to do about it is to finally let Jesus into all of those parts of you that you've walled off. I walled off a lot of parts of myself. I invited Jesus into the house, right? And like, but I closed the bedroom door and I closed the basement door. And like the parts that I let him into were very like clean, and he actually helped me clean up some of those stuff. But what I've realized is like, not only now do I have to let him into those other rooms, but man, I had like secret passageways. Like there was a bookcase that I had that like there was a secret door behind there. And so I hope that tonight, I'm not going to do some big like thing, but that you would leave here saying, I'm going to invite Jesus into those parts of myself. Let me pray. Lord, thank you for this opportunity to just share you, to talk about what you've done, the messy sanctification. I just ask that those who are here would realize, as the song said, as they were playing, the song was playing as they came in, only Jesus for my pain. That we all have traumas, that we all have brokenness, that sin has caused ruptures throughout our life. And the only thing that can truly give us peace and comfort in the face of even circumstances that get worse is you. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen. We're going to reset here. Again, you can leave. That's fine. We're just going to do a little Q&A. Autumn's got some questions. I think you guys have the opportunity. I can find this here, actually. If you have a question that you want to submit, you can do it there. Go to the bathroom, do what you need to do, and we'll be back in 10 minutes. 10 minutes.
For sharing your story. Yeah, we didn't get a chance to like clap at the end. Yeah. The bravery and just the honesty and the vulnerability that you were able to bring tonight and to share your story is like the gratitude is much from my heart to yours.
Well, thank you. And like, you know, I would say I was probably more nervous about tonight than like any other engagement. There's just something about coming back to your hometown. That's just different, right? Yeah. It's like your body remembers like all the places and all the things. And I'm sure there's people that are like, I remember you and what you did and what you talk like and still the jokes that I'm sure I crack on text and everything. So, thanks for having me.
Yeah. My history with John goes all the way back to his junior high year. Well, actually,
no,
it was before
that. Yeah.
Before, we had just, my husband and I had just moved to the area, and I was the art teacher at Trinity Christian School, and John was one of my students. And I joked last week that my constantly was like, Johnny, up here. No, Johnny, over here. And he was always fun to have in class, always.
But I'm glad that's the takeaway.
It was my takeaway. You were actually my favorite.
Yes!
You
I
were
knew
my
it.
Favorite. I loved your smile and your happiness, and you always just made everyone laugh. I like that. I enjoy that. Yeah, thank you for talking about addiction, but also what you brought to the table was the aspect of mental health in addiction. And I constantly think of Romans 12, 1 and 2, right? That that we need to be renewing our mind continually. Like that is part of the process as well. And you kind of touched on that without really saying it as much. I have a couple of questions. You talked about rupture and repair.
Yeah.
And that's super, super important in life. And why do you think it is that it's so hard to repair rupture when you've been a part of it?
I think, as my wife can tell you, that it requires humility. And my wife is watching right now. So, I love you. But I think it requires humility, right? It requires to say, the humility to even say, like, I didn't even intend that to happen, but I understand that it happened, and I'm still going to do what I can to try to bring healing, right? I mean, I think, like, you know, one of the things, like, my wife and I are still in counseling over over this, right? Like, sure. 2.5 years that I've been sober, and, like, we're still finding things to work through. And I think one of the hardest things for me was, like, she recently came to me and said, I'm now finally in a place where I'm realizing how it fully affected me. And, you know, I use the example, I don't know if anyone's gotten a car accident, but, like, you get in a car accident, and in the moment, like, if you don't have, like, a catastrophic injury, you're like, you know, the ambulance comes, and you're like, you need to go to the hospital, and you're like, no, I'm good, right? And then you get home, and, like, it's 2 hours later, and you're like, oh, my God, my back is killing me, right? Mm-hmm. Or, like, you know, where the seatbelt was, like, there's a lot of pain there. And I think that's where my wife has got to, right? Like, in the immediate 2.5 years, immediate, right? Like, immediate can be 5 years for some people. But in the immediate, it's like, okay, I'm sober. I'm not, like, derelict in my duties. I'm present. I'm, you know, all these great things. And then she gets home, and she's like, man, I'm feeling the pain from the car accident, right? Mm-hmm. From the seatbelt, right? And so I think the reason that repair is hard is because that has required me to say, in my flesh, I want to say, we're 2.5 years after this, and, like, we're still we're going to talk about this? Like, what do you mean, right? And I'm not tooting my horn that I'm this really humble person, because I've had to practice it, and my point is, we're going to counseling because it's hard to practice. But to say like, yeah, I get it. And so I'm going to do what's necessary to repair this. And that's hard. That's hard to do. And so whether that's in a spousal relationship, whether that's in a sibling relationship, whether that's in a parent-child relationship, it's hard. It's hard to do.
Yeah, I appreciated your the way that you talked about it and made me think about how difficult it is to admit that we've done something wrong, right? So as a parent, we want to be the best parents that we possibly can, and to have to hear a child come back and say, like, you hurt me, or you weren't listening, that's hard. We don't like to do that.
And two things can be true, right? Like, I this definition of wisdom was said to me once, and I think it's really good. The definition of wisdom is being able to hold two seemingly opposing things and know that they're both true.
Yep.
Right? So it can be true that I, as a parent, and I'll just use the example I used earlier tonight, it can be true that I, as a parent, have done my best with the tools that I have to guide my children through the last 2.5 years of not only my recovery, but my wife's health issues, right? And it can also be true that even despite that there are things that I've done to harm them. And they can be, I say this colloquially, but they can be sins of omission. And I think a lot of times, even as parents, they're sins of omission. Like, it's not that I've done something to you, it's that maybe I haven't offered something to you, right?
Correct.
And
yeah.
So with my kids, I think that, you know, if they come back in 10 years and say that, I'd be like, yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I'm sure. And I pray that I have the humility at the time to say, yeah, all right, yeah. Let's, I can't go back and fix that, right?
Right.
I can't be someone different. I can't do something different, but I can, like, what do you need? What do you need from me? Not like, what do you need?
Right.
But like, what do you need?
Right.
What will help?
Out of a curiosity, right?
Yeah.
A curiosity
yeah.
of like, I need to understand and know
yeah.
what I could do. So that kind of leads me into the next thing. Dan Allender, who is...
I love Dan.
Good guy. He talks about shame and the effect. And then really, that's what we're talking about with rupture and repair, right? It's hard to repair when we have this cloud of shame hanging over us. But he says the greatest killer of shame is love.
Mm.
And I wonder, I don't know that you really spoke to this specifically, but really it kind of comes down to the greatest command, right? That we need to love the Lord God with all of our heart, all of our mind, and all of our soul. Love your neighbor as you love yourself, right? And so the questions that you were asking yourself over and over, telling yourself about yourself, or the lies that we believe, right? Those are things that create a shame cloud, right? And it's hard for us to love ourselves. And how, like, in the church, how would you talk about that, do you think, as not loving yourself in this overindulgent way, but what does it mean to love ourselves?
I had this woman on my podcast, which is appropriately titled Confessions of a Christian Alcoholic. And she said this line that has just stuck with me. And she's like, you can't hate yourself to healing. And I'm like, dang, that's good. Right? Like, you can't hate yourself to healing. And I think especially as you're going through recovery, addiction recovery, food recovery, like whatever recovery that you're in, the devil's greatest tool is shame. And what I've learned, and I talk about this in the book, is there's a difference between worldly shame and godly grief. And I love, thank you, Linda, I love that the Bible gives us two really good examples of that. One is Judas, and the second one is Peter.
Yep.
And so Judas, like, immediately regrets what he's done by betraying Jesus, right? And what does he do? Like, he goes and kills himself. And there's actually this really, like, descriptive, I think it's in one of the Gospels, it might be Luke. Mm-hmm. Like, and they've done like some scientific research on this. He goes and he hangs himself. He sits there for so long that like his bowels spill out, right? Like, you talk about what shame can drive you to do. But then you have Peter, and Peter denies Jesus three times. After being told you're going to deny Jesus three times, and then saying like, there's no way I'm going to deny Jesus. There's no way I'm going to deny you, right? And Peter is instead filled with godly grief. And so like, well, what do you mean? Well, Peter doesn't go and obviously hang himself. He grieves over what he's done, right? And he says like, oh my gosh, how could I have done this? And godly grief leads you to action. And right action. And so there's actually this beautiful, beautiful, like, little story after Jesus comes back from the dead. And he appears to the disciples who have, like, gone back to going fishing, by the way. It's kind of interesting, right? Like,
right.
They go back to fishing and they're just like, okay.
Yep.
And Jesus appears on the shore, and what does Peter do? He runs out of the boat to Jesus. And like, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, when's the last time that Peter jumped out of a boat? Like, it didn't go well.
Right.
Right?
Right. He
like
sank.
He jumped out of a boat and he sank. But he is so overcome with godly grief that he's like, screw this. I'm jumping out. And I'm not saying he walked on water. But I'm saying he runs to Jesus and then becomes one of the greatest, you know, apostles that this world has ever seen.
Right.
How does that relate to love? Well, you can't give what you haven't received. And so I think what we see in Peter is that he receives the love of Christ. And so the difference between like a pride and like, oh, I'm just, you know, it's all about me, right? Mm-hmm. It's like when you receive the love of Christ, it emanates out towards you and it doesn't just stay in here. Like, why is the Dead Sea called the Dead Sea? Does anyone know? Because nothing runs out of it. Only things run into it. And so it just collects salt and salt and salt and salt and salt, right? And so I think Peter is a great example of what happens when you receive the love of Christ in a healthy way and then goes out and reflects that to the world. So that's the answer.
Yeah, great. That's a great answer.
I don't know, Kurt. How was that? Was that good?
What has the reaction been to people hearing your story with disordered drinking, especially from fellow Christians?
There's a person, I will remain nameless. I sent a copy of the book to you, and I asked this person if they would write an endorsement of the book. And this person said, I don't feel comfortable doing that. And I'm paraphrasing here because I can't show you the text messages because then you'd know who it was. And he said, dang it, I said he. And they said, I can't do that because I'm not comfortable because I'm not sure how you can call yourself a Christian and fall into ongoing sin. And like, there's some people who raise their eyebrows at that. But like, honestly, I think we take that posture a lot more than we think. You know, I live in Dallas, and like it seems like every week there's another pastor that's like falling, sexual sin,
right,
addiction, whatever. And it's hard for us to imagine that grace is still for them.
Yes.
And, you know, like I talked about Billy Graham and Tully and. Like, what was, I don't know if anyone knows, like, if you remember the song that Billy Graham always played at the end, at least one of them, was Come Just As You Are. And I think we treat the gospel as, it's okay, it's like, come as you are, but it's also stay as you become, right? And so, I've gotten plenty of reaction from other Christians and people who have said, you can't be a Christian alcoholic. I'm not sure if you were saved, whatever term you want to use. But I also think, like, even for those people who haven't been as vocal, and I'm guilty of this as well, right? And I've been guilty of it, right? Where, like, we treat people who fall majorly, the big sins. It's like, you're going to wear a scarlet letter, right?
Right.
Like, grace is for, it's okay if, like, you've stopped, you know, flipping people off in traffic. Like, there's grace for you. Like, is that if that's your struggle? But, you know, I was talking to Dee, and, you know, she's telling me about her grandson. And, you know, she's like, no one, like, they just beat up on him all the time. And I'm like, yeah, I did that. I did that with my sister, right? And then I became her. And we all are.
Yeah.
And so I think the reaction has been mixed, but yet there's also been great reaction, right? Like I don't want to say that there hasn't been. The elders at my church have been great. My home group has been great. They've really come alongside of us. But I think what the church needs to understand and embrace, and what I'm hoping my story can help them, is what I said at the end there, which is that sanctification is messy. And the gospel makes room for messy sanctification.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it kind of leads into my next question, which we talked about a little bit before you came up here. And that is, you know, What do you say when people say, you know, Jesus is enough? You shouldn't need therapy, or you shouldn't need other things to help you. Just read more scripture.
Yeah, and in my first book, I cover this a lot, and there's still great stuff in that book, right? I talk about, like, finding rest was like part one. I didn't realize I was writing part one, but it's part one of the story, right? Here's the funny thing. I even say in Finding Rest, I'm like, yeah, you know, with my mental health, I really need to watch how much I drink. I was watching it all right. You know what I mean? And by the way, I said at some point, like, there's a lot of explanations for why you become an alcoholic. And like, one of them for me is the anxiety and OCD. But what that comes down to is the escapism aspect, right? I want to escape those thoughts. I want to escape those ruminations. I want to, you know, that kind of thing. But therapy, medication, whatever, in that realm are what's called common graces. And they're things that the Lord has provided for us that allow us to fight back against them, right? So like I still take medication every day for my OCD and my anxiety, right? Therapy, I mean, I know that there are people who can be and have been miraculously healed of their drinking problem. And I'm like, praise God. Right. Like, that is awesome. Good for you. Just like there are people who are miraculously cured of cancer. But just because there are those people who are miraculously cured of cancer, Terry needs to get chemotherapy and he needs to get radiation.
Yep.
Right? And you're praying for that and we're all praying for that. But like, if he were to just say, screw it, like, I'm believing for my miracle. And so there's a story I tell in the first book, which is, there's this flood, and it's coming, and, you know, as you all know, like, from the spring, flash floods in Texas are a very real thing, right? And so this flash flood happens, and the sheriff's office comes, and they tell this guy, they're like, hey, there's a flood coming, let's go, come on. And he's like, no, I'm believing Jesus for my miracle, it's going to be good, he's going to take care of me. And, like, the waters rise. And the sheriff department's comes back in a boat. And they're like, hey, you really need to come with us. He's like, no, I'm believing Jesus for my miracle. It's going to be good. I'm trusting him. And then, like, he gets onto the roof of his house. And there's a helicopter that comes. And they're like,
get in the helicopter.
Right? And he's like, no, I'm believing Jesus for my miracle. You don't understand. And, like, he dies. And he goes to heaven. And he gets up and he's like, Jesus, like, I don't understand. I, like, had the faith. I put it into action. I really thought that you were going to come through. And Jesus looks at him and says, I sent you a car, a boat, and a helicopter. What more did you want? Right?
Yeah.
And so I think therapy, medication, like, it's those things. Right? My therapist is a Christian woman, and, like, my goodness, I give her a shout out in my book. I think I've referred probably 25 people to her because the Lord has blessed her with a ministry. She's a licensed therapist. She's a Christian. It's like, it's this perfect world, right? And it's awesome. And so I would say in a perfect world, and in fact, in the perfect world, in Genesis 1, Jesus, God was enough. And then we made a really stupid decision. And we chose the route where he wasn't enough, right? Yep. And he
has been, to do it our own way, right?
Exactly. And he's been gracious enough since then to send boats and helicopters and cars. And yeah, if we were in Genesis 1 and we could just walk and talk in the garden in the cool of the day, like, great. But now, in a broken, sinful world that's been ruptured, he's offering these things to us.
Yeah. And he's always calling us back to Eden, right?
Mm.
That's what he created us for, was for Eden. And he's always wanting, and I think, calling us back to that place. So your therapist sounds like she's maybe narrative focused therapy trained.
She does this thing called EMDR, mm-hmm. which I'm a big fan of. Eye movement desensitization, yep. something like that.
Yep.
And it's really fascinating. What happens is when you stimulate both sides of your brain, so I grab these tappers and they vibrate. And it seems weird, and it is a little bit, but that stimulates both parts of your brain. And when you stimulate both parts of your brain, I talked about the prefrontal cortex, talked about the amygdala, like you're able to, in a sense, use more of your brain and access things. You're able to access memories. You're able to access feelings, like, why am I feeling this way? And part of what I describe it to people is, like, regular talk therapy is like, hey, I'm afraid of flying. And so they're like, okay, talk therapy, let's talk through that. And then there's a type of therapy that is, like they're gonna exposure therapy. And so then like one day you like go to the airport and you drive around the cell phone lot and you come back. And then the next day you go to the terminal. Yep. And you come back. And then the next day you go to the jet bridge and then you come back. And it's like, great. Like they'll get you over your fear of flying that way. But like EMDR is like, why? Why are you afraid of flying? Oh my gosh. John, take me back to when you first felt that feeling. Well, I'm like, this is not true. I'm making this up. But I don't have a fear of flying. But I remember I'm like six and I'm on the playground at Jefferson and it's after school and my dad is there and he's with my sister as well. And I'm at the top of the slide and I'm like, Dad, will you catch me? And he says, yes. And I go to jump. But as I go to jump, my sister falls down and my dad goes to get my sister and I jump and he doesn't catch me. Oh my gosh. Okay. Now what we're going to do is we're going to invite Jesus into that. Like, you know, seen, safe, soothed, and secure.
Yeah.
How can we make you feel now using your prefrontal cortex as an adult? Let's think about that. Which, by the way, and I said this earlier, is like, that's not dad's fault.
Right.
So, by the way, that's a trauma mm-hmm. caused by dad. That's not his fault, right? And so you invite Jesus in. Let's rethink that through. Now, do you understand that? Oh, my gosh, yes. So there's also story work, which you and I have talked a lot
yes.
about. And story work says, we're going to go to, and it's very similar in a sense to EMDR, because you go back to, when's the earliest, like, why am I feeling when my, the chicken nugget example, which is not a far off example, because in my first book, I talk about how my wife gave me the wrong sweetener, and it triggered me.
Sure.
And there were things going on in my brain, right? But like that's, you could use that as an example of like, okay, I'm triggered by something really like benign. Why? Right? And it's like, man, I remember, and again, this is not true. This is not my story, but I'm just making it up. Like, I remember that one time I asked, I asked my dad for this. And he said, you stupid idiot. Why would you ever want Sweet and Low? Or, why would you ever want Splenda? That stuff is, do you know that stuff kills you? Aren't you you idiot? And so now, I get the wrong sweetener, and it's like, my gosh, my body and my mind remembers that feeling, right? And so now the simplest thing is getting the wrong sweetener triggers something like that. And we should go back and work through that.
Good. Yep, and that's what we do in narrative-focused story work.
Yeah.
I have not received any questions. I don't know if anyone has tried to use the QR code and ask any questions. Anyone? No one? You have one?
You couldn't get it to work? I'm
Joey,
sorry.
Do you have a question?
Did it show up?
Oh, yes. I got it. All right, here it is.
Okay.
How can receiving therapy from a therapist be a real-world application of being the hands and feet of Jesus, like receiving the love of Jesus through the work of therapy and story work. Do you want to read it?
Joey, is there any more clarification you can offer?
Yeah, I would just say, like, how is receiving therapy from a therapist equal to receiving the love of Jesus here on earth? How does God use therapists?
Well, I'm thinking of the verse, like, God causes it to rain on the just and the unjust, right? And so you can have a farmer who's sitting there and it starts to rain, right? And he can be mad at God and say, I don't want that. What are you doing? Like, take the rain. Like, we would be like, well, that's asinine, right? Like, God is giving you a gift that you need. Your crops, like, need the rain. But maybe because you're like, well, you know, I wanted it on my terms, right? I wanted it on Tuesday, but not on Monday, right? And it's like, it's rain. It's a good gift, right? So I think that's one aspect of it. And I would say, I think we get very prideful and we try to tell God he can only move and work in the ways that we want him to work. And we say, like I'll go back to the medication thing, right? Like, my pastor, and I'm not breaking confidence here because he's talked about this, during COVID, like a lot of pastors, so much was thrown on him, you know, and you're trying to, these people are saying open up, these people are saying shut down, these, you know, like all that stuff. And he starts having panic attacks and he starts getting anxiety. And, you know, he knew that I think at the time I was writing the book on that. And so we had a conversation and one of the things I said to him was like, isn't it pride to say that God, you can move in any way you want except for this? Like, it's just prideful, right? It's like, and you know, I go back to the boat thing, right? And so what I would say, Joey, is like, if God is offering you something and you're rejecting it, that's not good, right? Like, there's salvation. Like, let's use salvation. God is offering you salvation and you're rejecting it, right? And we can get into the theology of that, Kurt, but, you know, it's like, if God is offering you something and you're saying no, you're not like in the best flourishing life. So that's how I would kind of answer that.
Yeah, and I might just add, you know, right, psychology, like the psyche, is actually wisdom, right? Mm. And we can look at Proverbs, we can look at God's word for wisdom, but God uses people as well to offer wisdom.
We were made to be in community.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And so my therapist is part of my community, right? Like, she's offering me godly wisdom that's marrying science and, you know, all the best of all worlds. And I'm like, this is great.
Right.
Like, I understand myself better. I understand God better. Those are good things.
Yeah. What would you say to the parent or the spouse who sees the other person going down a road of addiction? And that, I mean, what would you have wanted? What would have maybe you heard? I don't know. On this side of healing, do you think that there's any anything helpful for those that maybe are watching someone who's in addiction, active addiction, that feel helpless?
I originally, when I wrote the book, I had in the outline, I had a chapter on this. Because in my first book, I had a whole chapter on this, like, how do you help people who are struggling with mental health? And I got to the point, I got to like in the outline where I'm about to write this chapter, and I'm like, I can't offer any universal guidance here. Because some people need the intervention. If my wife would have staged an intervention, it wouldn't have worked. Now, maybe I would have gotten sober for a little bit, just out of the pure humiliation and shame and whatnot, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what my wife realized is she needed to just let it play out. And her big thing, and I would try like for years. I'd like cut back, and then, you know, I get to a point and I'd be like, hey, are you okay like if I just start having two? Right? And she's like, I'm not the Holy Spirit. And that created a lot more immediate pain for her.
I can imagine.
Like, she chose not to be the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. She could have easily said, it's two or I'm leaving, right? But for her, having known me, she's like, he's got to come to where, like, this is fully between him and God, and he does this, meaning give it up, for that reason. And so that was her approach. Like I said, I've known some people who've staged interventions, some people who said, you're going to treatment or I'm out. And that does become a catalyst. Like, that's not to say that if you do that, like, a person can't find long-term recovery and can't find Jesus. And so I would say it's not a trite answer, and it's not, I'm not trying to dodge the question, but it's just something that you have to seek the Lord about. And my wife and I are actually going to be doing a podcast episode where I invite spouses of people who have fallen into addiction to talk about this, because there's not a one size fits all. And from experience, my wife can tell you, like, that's hard. It's really hard.
Well, I was thinking as you were talking, like, for the person who's watching someone in active addiction and not knowing what to do, could be their addiction of trying to fix, right?
Mm.
And how difficult that is. Like, for your wife, it had to have been very difficult to watch you destroy yourself and think of the children, think of the people in your life.
And let me be clear, like, that's not to say, and while my wife knew it was getting bad towards the end, I still was hiding, like, she didn't know all of it, right?
Right.
And so that's not to say that, like, if I'm obviously drunk and I'm taking the keys and we're leaving a restaurant, that my wife is just supposed to be like, I'm just going to let him go. I'm just going to, you know, let him get on the highway, right? Like, there are things that you can, like, do in the immediate that I think we're called to do, right? There was never an incident like that with my wife and I. But I just want to be clear about, like, when I'm talking about not staging an intervention or not getting involved, it wasn't just like my wife was like, you know.
Totally hands-on.
Right, exactly.
She was just using wisdom as she was.
Exactly.
But also still having to stand back.
Yeah.
And not be the Holy Spirit.
And how many of us have to do that with our kids?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like my son, especially. Mm-hmm. All right, buddy. Fine. You're just going to have to learn this one. Mm-hmm. Because I can tell you and tell you and tell you not to do that. Right? And you just got to learn it for yourself.
Yeah, and having boundaries, right, is something that's difficult in a relationship where there is codependence, which, you know, alcoholism or drug addiction, that usually goes hand in hand.
Yep.
Is codependence. To have boundaries means to actually create the safety and the security in a relationship that we're really longing for, but we don't know how to get.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, other questions that, like, I haven't been able to get any other questions on my phone that I'm missing. Someone, you have a question?
Yeah. Kristen. Just wondering, so, if you know somebody that's in complete denial, you know, of their addiction,
So the question is, if you didn't hear that, if you know someone who's in active addiction, how do you help them?
Yeah, and I wish I could give you, like, the perfect answer. I do. And I think if I could, there'd be a lot more people that don't suffer. Because I didn't do that. Like, that's a question I'd ask myself with my sister. And it's a question my wife would ask dealing with me, right? And again, I'm not trying to cop out, but like, there has to be like wisdom and guidance that you seek from the Lord. And I would say also from others as well. Maybe the other people that are in this person's life, right, that can offer you wisdom and insights on like how to best reach them. But it's just gonna depend. It really is. Yeah.
Because they are in denial. You know, they see situations that are, you know, getting blackout drunk. Well, I'm not that. You know, that comparison.
And so it's funny you say that, because in the book I talk about this, like, that's one of the things I used to say. I'm not getting blackout drunk. I rarely have missing pieces in my life. And I said, because I don't have missing pieces, I'm good. Well, there's blackout drunk. Yes, that's one way. And there's also gray outs and there's brown outs. And so I tell the story in the book, like towards the end, I would be drunk by, you know, now 7, 5, whenever. And I had the wherewithal to take out my phone. And if my wife and I were having a conversation, I would take notes about the conversation so that in the morning I could remember the conversation. Because I would say I remember that we were having a conversation. That's not blackout drunk. I remember talking to you. Now the details are a little fuzzy, right? So I'd open up my phone in the morning and I'd find a way to talk about the conversation that we had, like to bring it back up as kind of like, obviously, I remember the conversation, so I wasn't bad, right?
Well, and it's interesting that your ability to be so incredibly manipulative is pretty intense. Like, you really had thought that out, how to be manipulative, but yet that's also part of addiction, right?
Yeah.
The manipulation. And so, like, did you ever get caught?
Yes, and I would say, you know, those are the times where I said my wife was noticing it. She didn't know the full extent, but so maybe you get caught once in a month, and you're like,
but
yeah.
In the manipulation.
Like, I'm trying to think of a good example. I'm sure I did, and she's watching this, and she can text me. If
the question,
but maybe I didn't write that down in the notes app. But yeah, I got caught at times, but you also just learn to justify it. And I do write this in the book. And I think one of the things that we're dealing with in counseling is then I would gaslight her, you know, and say, that's not really what happened. You're misremembering that. Or, you know, just try to downplay it, justify it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think there are times that, you know, she starts doubting herself. Well, yeah, maybe I am wrong, right? And so gaslighting, like, it's one of those terms that we hear and talk about a lot. But like, yeah, that's what I would do and was doing, you know?
Yeah. Good. Any other questions?
Awesome.
You got all your answers.
Now
go out and buy the book, Confessions of a Christian Alcoholic. Thank you so much, John, for making Manitowoc your first stop on your tour. Like, it's kind of a big deal.
Well, thank you for having me. Like I said, I'm doing some other stuff. Like, you know, I'll be in Georgia and kind of all that stuff. And I'm not nervous about those, right? Like, but I was nervous about this one. You know, there's just something. And I was joking with my mom a little bit at lunch, but like, even Jesus was like, a prophet is not welcome in his hometown. Right. And my mom's like, it's not that you're not welcome. I'm like, no. It's the idea that the hardest thing to do is for anyone to go back to their hometown and talk about stuff and see the people and whatnot, right? There's just something about it. So thank you for being gracious. And I'm glad I kicked it off because it all gets easier from here.
It should be all downhill.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, well, can I just pray a blessing over
please.
You? Please. Father God, we just thank you for this evening. We thank you for John. We thank you, Lord, that you have redeemed and continue to redeem his story. I thank you, Father, for the memories that have been stored in his body that have continued to surface to the top. You continue to reveal yourself in the midst of it. And I pray, Father, just a blessing over him. I pray a blessing over this book, that it would touch many lives and many hearts that need to hear that there is hope. There is hope not just for sobriety, but there is hope that you can actually be the one to restore. So, Father, I just ask that you would go before John, bless his efforts, and bless the book and all of that. Bless his family. Be with his wife. Heal her, Father. And we just thank you. We thank you for John, and we thank you for his story and what you're doing. In Jesus' name, amen.